Coast Guard Commandant Paul Yost plans to decide within the next week whether to approve Exxon's revised plan for cleaning up the oil spill in Alaska's Prince William Sound. Exxon gave state and federal authorities a new version of the cleanup strategy yesterday, just hours before the deadline. Yost rejected Exxon's first proposal last month, saying it was incomplete. From Anchorage, Steve Heimel of Alaska Public Radio reports.
The revised plan from Exxon adds 60 miles to the shoreline the company proposes to clean up, but cuts back on the proposed labor force to do it. Coast Guard Admiral Paul Yost had told Exxon to include oiled areas outside of Prince William Sound in the plan, and that's been done. 364 miles are now proposed to be cleaned, but only 3 miles of oil-soaked coastline are on the list for immediate attention. And Exxon says 191 miles of what it calls lightly oiled shoreline are best left to natural wave action for cleaning. The earlier scheme envisioned 4,000 people working on the cleanup. The new one plans on 3,400. Admiral Yost is expected in Valdez today to look the plan over. State officials have not yet put together a response. For National Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska, I'm Steve Heimel.
In Alaska, a revised plan to clean up the Exxon oil spill is now being reviewed by the state and the U.S. Coast Guard. The earlier Exxon plan was judged to be incomplete. The strategy, a plan of action running until September 15th, now includes parts of the Gulf of Alaska as well as Prince William Sound, but would leave many miles of oiled shoreline untreated. And the plan calls for the burning of oily sludge that cannot be recycled. For that to happen, Exxon would have to be exempted from some local environmental laws. The Exxon plan was drawn up in consultation with local groups in Alaska, among them the Prince William Sound Conservation Alliance. Nancy Lethko, who's a charter boat operator in Valdez, is a founder of the alliance. She's now serving on the Shoreline Advisory Committee, helping decide which places get cleaned up. Her main concern about this new Exxon plan involves the calendar.
The weather window really starts to degenerate around the 1st of September, and in fact, it can, even as early as the first or second week of August, we can start getting the tail end of some of those typhoons that come across from Japan. It can get pretty nasty. And I understand their original estimates of the number of days of downtime were based on the assumption that they would be able to work in gale force winds. However, we have since discovered that they cannot work their skimmers in anything more than about a 1 foot sea or less. And skimming is an essential part of the shoreline cleanup because they flush the oil off the shore into the water and then skim it. So if they can't skim, then they're going to have a much greater amount of downtime than anticipated. And that, of course, will put them behind schedule.
What does the plan say, as you understand it, about the most controversial aspect of this, that local environmental laws would need to be suspended so that Exxon could burn some sludge that they might recover from the beaches or the water?
Well, we're hoping that no local environmental laws are suspended. That would be of great concern to us. We have an air quality problem in Valdez already with the Alyeska pipeline terminal. At the moment, we have a yellow haze over Valdez. So the addition of more air pollution would be unacceptable to the local community.
Would you feel the same way about, for different reasons, about the proposal to possibly bury some of this sludge?
No, I believe that incineration is the best way to handle the problem, but what has happened is that they are using equipment that falls beneath the state regulations. What we need are for Exxon to really take the lead and put in state-of-the-art technology for a incinerator that has scrubbers and would exceed the air quality requirements.
Aren't you being just a bit tough on Exxon? They've had all these other problems logistically with getting equipment into Prince William Sound, and now you're saying they'll have to bring in special incineration equipment just to burn the sludge they may possibly recover?
Well, it's not only sludge. It's the materials they use to wipe up the beaches with. That is a hazardous waste. It's a plastic. It can't just be burned or buried. It has to be burnt at a certain temperature. So there's quite a volume of materials, particularly plastics, covered with oil crude that will need to be disposed.
Well, what about the general notion that 191 miles of beaches, coastline, fouled to some degree by the oil, will be left untouched and to be cleaned up, as the company has said from time to time, by Mother Nature?
Yes, that for me at the beginning of this was one of the most difficult things to understand and to accept. But if we were to come in there with flushing equipment, with hoses, and agitate the beach pebbles, sand, and cobbles that have this light oiling on it, we would be killing all the intertidal zone life, which would in it that way be more damage than was originally caused by the oil.
From Valdez, Alaska, Nancy Lethko, the founder of the Prince William Sound Conservation Alliance.
Environmental groups have declared this a national day of mourning for Prince William Sound. That's the area in Alaska where this country's worst oil spill took place. Memorial services are planned for a number of cities. There'll be a candlelight vigil here in Washington. Gordon Hempton, who calls himself the Sound Tracker, wanted to take part in the Valdez Memorial in some way. You may remember we visited Mr. Hempton a few months ago. He goes into the wild to record the sounds of nature undisturbed by civilization. Last week, Gordon Hempton trekked out to the Olympic Peninsula in Washington State to record the kinds of pure and natural sounds that no longer exist at Prince William Sound. Here's what he found. The sounds of nature untouched, recorded by Gordon Hempton on the Olympic Peninsula in Washington State. Environmentalists are holding memorial services today for Prince William Sound. You're listening to...
This is Morning Edition. I'm Bob Edwards. Today in Valdez, Alaska, a congressional delegation is expected to hear a final day of testimony on the wreck of the Exxon Valdez oil tanker. More than 10 million gallons of oil spilled into Prince William Sound when the Exxon Valdez struck a reef nearly 2 months ago. State officials, industry representatives, and fishermen are testifying at the hearings, which began yesterday. Bruce Melzer of member station KSKA reports from Valdez.
California Democrat George Miller organized this hearing to confront the oil industry with what he calls its broken promises to protect Alaska's coast. And he started with Alyeska, the oil company that slipped into the background almost as soon as the oil spill occurred. It's a consortium of seven major oil companies, including Exxon, that operates the Trans-Alaska Pipeline and the Valdez Oil Terminal. Exxon has since assumed responsibility for cleaning up what is now the largest oil spill in U.S. history, but it was Alyeska that first responded, as required by law. It was a response Alaska's Commissioner of Environmental Conservation describes as reluctant, Dennis Kelso.
The industry's response during the first critical 72 hours of the spill was ineffective, in part because of Alyeska Pipeline Service Company's decade-long efforts to scuttle any meaningful oil spill contingency plan. Second, Alyeska failed to carry out their oil spill plan, and Exxon was unprepared and unable to implement an effective response.
Several members of the House Interior Subcommittee on Water, Power, and Offshore Energy Resources appear to share that conclusion. When it put Alyeska officials under oath, the committee didn't ask for prepared remarks and started right in with the questioning and cross-examining. Committee members produced letters which they said contained assurances from Alyeska that it could handle a spill as big as that of the Exxon Valdez. But an Alyeska vice president, Theo Pulaczyk, disputed that. Illinois Democrat Richard Durbin kept pushing.
I'm going to quote you here. This isn't something we're making up from a man who's not here from a letter you disavow. This is something that your company presented. It is estimated that approximately 50% of the oil will be recovered at sea.
Recovered with dispersant.
Either directly after the spill or at a later time by being washed off the rocks, contained, and skimmed off of the water.
But recovery in this sense means recovery mechanically or through use of dispersants or burning.
Durbin and others on the panel weren't satisfied with the answers Alyeska was giving, and each took turns lecturing the company officials. CEO Pulaczyk defended Alyeska's oil spill plan, saying the company did follow through, but Representative George Miller didn't like the result.
We have to remember, I left here 3 weeks ago saying that this thing was a complete and total failure.
Right.
I think what I've had reinforced is that, in fact, this is a complete and total failure.
The congressman says the oil industry will now face much harsher scrutiny as it seeks to explore wilderness areas of Alaska or offshore waters throughout the United States. For National Public Radio, I'm Bruce Melzer in Valdez, Alaska.
Exxon says it can clean up the worst of the Alaska oil spill by September 15th, but the Coast Guard is skeptical. Nearly 2 months ago, the Exxon Valdez oil tanker hit a reef in Prince William Sound, spilling more than 10 million gallons of oil. Yesterday, a Coast Guard official said he thinks Exxon will have to continue the cleanup effort on the Alaska coast next spring. That was just one issue on which Exxon differed from the Coast Guard and Alaska state officials at the final day of a congressional hearing in Valdez. Bruce Melzer of member station KSKA reports.
The biggest contradiction surfaced when Exxon said it repeatedly urged the quick use of chemicals to break up the spill. Exxon USA President W.B. Stevens says the state and federal authorities moved too slowly.
We're confident that had we obtained prompt permission to use dispersants, the environmental damage from the spill would have been significantly mitigated.
But the Coast Guard and the state's top environmental officials say Exxon never sought widespread use of the chemicals. Committee Chair George Miller tried to reconcile the different stories by questioning the Coast Guard officers responsible for the decision, Captain Steve McCall and Vice Admiral Clyde Robbins.
Admiral, this is obviously, we're down to the core here. The state said that they did not deny either Alyeska or Exxon the ability to use dispersants had they so chosen to do that. You're the third party here. Did the Coast Guard deny Exxon the ability to use dispersants?
To my knowledge, they did not.
Mr. McCall?
No, sir.
Captain McCall.
Alaska's officials say Exxon is waging a disinformation campaign in an effort to make it appear as though the company could have handled a spill that was out of control from the beginning. Failing to resolve the conflicts in the testimony, Oregon Democrat Peter DeFazio simply ran out of patience with the oil company executive.
We have a problem between the testimony of the Coast Guard, ADEC, and your testimony regarding restraints upon the use of this. I think you got further constraints in terms of availability, the application aircraft, the amount of light you had and all that, but I mean, it's a little too much to get into right now.
Well, let me just
go to something really simple. I mean,
okay.
You've made your assertion. Other people have made conflicting assertions. It'll get sorted out. I want to deal with something really simple.
Yes.
And let's talk about birds and otters.
But even that wasn't simple. Exxon said it opened a center in the town of Seward last Friday to clean oil-covered otters. But actress Loretta Swit told the congressman as of 2 days ago, the facility wasn't opened. The state and Exxon disagree over how much time it will take to clean up the spill and what to do with the oily waste. These issues are bound to come up again as Congress continues its investigation into the nation's worst oil spill. For National Public Radio, I'm Bruce Melzer in Valdez.
Three states and a Canadian province have joined forces in an attempt to prevent disasters like the Valdez oil spill. A regional task force, which includes officials from the federal government, the states of Alaska, Washington, and Oregon, and the province of British Columbia, is meeting today in Seattle. Carol Levinson reports.
The task force was formed after a 231,000-gallon oil spill off the Washington coast last December killed at least 10,000 birds and soiled the beaches all the way up to Vancouver Island in British Columbia. At the time, Washington State and the Canadian province decided they should team up to improve communications between the neighboring jurisdictions in case such a spill happened again. Ron Holcomb represents Washington's Department of Ecology.
One thing we're trying to do is benefit from each of our government's experience, and rather than reinvent the wheel on some of these things, hopefully we can provide information to the other governments and vice versa on experience in not only dealing with cleanup of oil spills, but possibly in whatever laws or regulations that are in place that are effective.
Ironically, Holcomb says, the day after the two governments held their first meeting, the Exxon Valdez ran aground in Alaska's Prince William Sound. That prompted an invitation to Alaska and then to Oregon to join the task force. Today is the first gathering of all four governments, but the group has already finished its first project. Exxon has said it might tow the Valdez to Portland, Oregon for repairs, traveling down the coast near British Columbia and Washington State. The task force members have pooled their expertise and prepared a 23-page agreement for Exxon to sign to satisfy the region's requirements if the Valdez is going to pass through nearby waters. Carolyn Young of Oregon's Department of Environmental Quality says the message is much stronger coming from more than one entity.
And so by speaking to Exxon with one voice, I think we're able to say to them that no environmental damage is acceptable anywhere along the coastlines or the Columbia River, and we're not only concerned about our own coastline, but we share those concerns with our sister states and sister province.
Exxon has yet to respond to the region's agreement, but Ron Holcomb of Washington's Ecology Department says it will have to before sending the Valdez to the Pacific Northwest.
Bottom line is, if they cannot meet those conditions, then frankly, don't want the Exxon Valdez to come to Portland.
In the meantime, the task force will continue studying oil spill prevention and cleanup issues before coming out with a final report at the end of the year. For National Public Radio, I'm Carol Levinson in Seattle.
On Capitol Hill this week, a series of hearings on the Exxon oil spill in Prince William Sound, Alaska. Testimony to be given about tanker safety and damage to marine life and birds and the status of the cleanup in general. There have been 2 days of hearings in Valdez. Also, five members of Congress traveling to Alaska for a survey and to ask questions there. And in Valdez, officials from Exxon restated in testimony that their request to use chemical dispersants just after the oil was spilled were turned down by Alaska and the Coast Guard. Exxon said the company could have cleaned up half of the oil from the water. Dennis Kelso, Alaska's Commissioner of Environmental Conservation, calls these claims by Exxon a fabrication and disinformation.
The truth is that, first of all, there was no delay by the state of Alaska for Exxon to use chemical dispersants or anything else. On March 7th and 8th, we had pre-approved the use of chemical dispersants in Zone 1, which is the area where the spill moved rather quickly from the tanker. And the real issue is that Exxon was not prepared to respond to this spill, whether through mechanical means or chemical dispersants. They didn't have the equipment, they didn't have the materials, and they couldn't do the response that they had promised. The contingency plan that was agreed to simply wasn't carried out.
What did Exxon say during the hearings in Valdez as to why the contingency plan, the mechanical cleanup, didn't go into effect?
Well, I don't think there is a good explanation. The contingency plan, which is basically the plan that says how the industry will respond to a spill, was specific about certain equipment being available, having it deployed within a particular time period, putting teams of specialists in the field to do the response, and none of that happened. When I arrived with the governor in the afternoon of the first day of the spill, we went on board the tanker and observed a very lackadaisical approach, a couple of skimmers kind of working, a barge that was loaded with equipment that hadn't even unloaded the equipment. There was no boom around the tanker as had been promised in the contingency plan. The teams that were to have been deployed never materialized. Basically, what happened is that the companies didn't take the contingency planning process very seriously. They didn't really believe that this would happen, and when it did, they were completely unready. Let me give you one example. In 1984, we held a drill for Alyeska to demonstrate their readiness, and they didn't perform well at all. And we called them on it, said, you're going to have to do better. This is just not acceptable. And their answer was, well, this is only a drill. If this had been a real emergency, of course we would have done something differently. Well, the whole point of a drill is to be ready in case of an emergency. That is your margin of safety. That is your preparedness. If you have that kind of attitude, of course you're not going to be ready to handle a spill, and of course they weren't.
Let's talk about from here on out. Exxon has spent more than $95 million so far. They're to employ almost 4,000 people. They're accepting full responsibility, say they will pay for all of it. What more would you have them do at this point?
At this point, they need to pay attention to areas outside of Prince William Sound, in addition to keeping the work going on Prince William Sound.
You mean out in the Gulf of Alaska?
In the Gulf of Alaska, along the Kenai Peninsula, down Shelikov Straits. They need to do in-the-water cleanup as long as it can be accomplished. They need to say what they're going to do specifically on shoreline cleanup, both inside and outside of Prince William Sound. They need to prepare for sound waste management. We're not about to waive environmental regulations for Exxon's convenience.
Now, the 15th of September is the target date in the new cleanup plan from Exxon. What is your understanding about what happens after September 15th if there is much to be cleaned up? What happens? Who does what?
If there is work remaining after September 15th, then we're going to expect Exxon to come back and do that. But we think that every area needs to be treated this first summer. And by that, I mean we need to get as much oil off those shorelines as we can. The deadline for getting the shorelines cleaned in areas where seals and sea lions are going to be coming ashore to give birth to their pups is tomorrow. It's very important to the survival of those pups, that they not be in contact with that oil and that there not be disturbance from cleaning activity. Both of those can be fatal to these vulnerable little pups. So we're waiting to see now. Exxon has promised to get it done in that time, and May 10th is the date. So we're waiting to see whether they live up to that promise.
Dennis Kelso, Commissioner of Alaska's Department of Environmental Conservation. He's in Washington today for congressional hearings on the oil spill. There is now, by the way, a new figure for the amount of oil that was lost into Prince William Sound. It's reported that Exxon now agrees with Alaska. The number should be revised from 10.1 million gallons to 10.9 million.
Since the oil boom of the mid-1970s, the Alaska legislature has traditionally watered down or rejected pro-environmental bills. But this year's session was different. By the time Alaska lawmakers adjourned last week, they had passed a dozen tough bills. Elizabeth Arnold of member station KTOO in Juneau reports on how the Exxon oil spill at Valdez has changed the course of Alaska politics.
For over a decade, Alaska politics have been driven by oil. 85% of the state's revenues come from oil taxes and royalties. ARCO, BP, and Exxon are the state's top campaign contributors and have pumped millions into key legislative races. Oil producers have lobbied to keep taxes low, and environmentalists charge the industry with weakening pollution controls. But in the 48 days since the tanker Exxon Valdez struck a shallow reef in Prince William Sound, pro-oil industry sentiment has run aground. By the final hours of the legislative session, lawmakers had passed a multi-billion dollar oil tax increase and a package of spill bills guaranteed to make the industry think twice about prevention. Alaska Governor Steve Cooper just minutes after adjournment.
I don't think Alaska politics will ever be the same.
The Democratic governor has been fighting since he took office in 1986 to change an oil industry tax break that was being applied to the state's two most productive oil fields. The Republican-controlled Senate had avoided a vote on the issue for 3 years, and this year didn't seem any different. The oil industry put millions of dollars into ad campaigns with the message that drilling and exploration would slow if the tax was tinkered with. But in the 7 weeks after the spill, the public's attitude toward the industry reversed, and the legislature was forced to take up the measure. Governor Steve Cooper.
I think it's clear that most of the people of the state of Alaska, but prior to the spill, were prepared to accept most of what the industry said at face value. After the spill, they were no longer willing to do so.
Just hours before the vote, oil lobbyists lined the halls of the Capitol building, and lawmakers were promised increased union jobs on the North Slope oil fields. Kotzebue Democrat Al Adams asked about those promises.
Who has made these promises? Is it the same industry that have promised that a Prince William Sound oil spill would never happen? Is it the same industry that promised that they would not kill animals? The same industry that had a contingency plan for a major oil spill? Stop doing them a favor and hold them accountable for their actions.
The tax measure passed the Senate and will add $2 billion to the state's treasury in the next 2 decades. Some of it will be put toward the cleanup of the Exxon spill. The tax bill isn't the only indication of the state's broken friendship with the industry. 32 bills were introduced to regulate, fine, and prevent the disposal and discharge of hazardous substances, particularly crude oil. But not every legislator jumped on the bandwagon. Anchorage Representative Red Boucher.
I call these conscience bills. All of a sudden, bills that hadn't been introduced for years here, they look like tankers lined up outside of Valdez. I mean, it was one after the other, and it was pretty hard to evaluate what they did. This was purely reactionary legislation.
Bills were passed creating a statewide response master plan and a commission to investigate the Valdez spill. Legislation sailed through the House and Senate, putting strict liability on companies involved in spills, and fines were increased from $10 to $50 a gallon. Oil production taxes were raised a nickel a barrel to pay for the state's response to future disasters. Whether enough incentives and deterrents are in place now to force the industry to take more precautions to prevent spills will be debated by future legislatures. Some lawmakers, like Representative Peter Gall, say it will depend on how deeply Alaskans have been affected by the spill in Prince William Sound.
It will be a shame if the reaction is a short-term reaction. It's clearly in the corporate interest of any polluter to minimize regulation on their pollution. It's just a question of dollars in someone's pocket.
But the reminder of the price paid for rapid, unchecked resource development will be around for years. A few legislators are heading home this weekend to districts where beaches and bays are covered with the same crude oil that paved their way into office. For National Public Radio, I'm Elizabeth Arnold in Juneau, Alaska.
This is Morning Edition. I'm Bob Edwards. Tomorrow, in Anchorage, Alaska, the National Transportation Safety Board begins 5 days of hearings into the cause of the Exxon Valdez accident. The oil tanker, which has one of the world's most sophisticated guidance systems, ran aground in a 10-mile-wide channel in Prince William Sound on March 24th. The tanker released nearly 11 million gallons of North Shore crude into the Sound, fouling 800 miles of shoreline. Joining us from Anchorage is Howard Weaver, managing editor of the Anchorage Daily News. Howard, the NTSB hearings open tomorrow. What is still unclear at this stage of the investigation?
Well, Bob, you know there are bound to be a lot of questions left unanswered when you have essentially an unlicensed third officer piloting a tanker into a charted, lighted reef on a clear, calm night. Really, all the questions about how something like that could come to pass in the age of radar tracking and autopilots is very much at question at this point.
Why did the Exxon Valdez stray into the channel? Was the captain drunk? All those sort of things.
That's right. The captain apparently was not on the bridge at the time, which is probably question number one. The third officer who was piloting the tanker when it ran aground was not documented or licensed to be operating the vessel in that particular location. They were on the left-hand side of a two-way tanker channel and, in fact, hit the reef from the left-hand side. And so all of those questions, they've been undercover so far. Investigators have talked to some of these people, but very little of that has been made public. And so when the various witnesses take the stand in the Captain Cook Hotel here, that will be the first time publicly we've heard many of them speak about the accident.
But it has all been discussed in the press. Do you expect anything new to come out of the hearings?
There have been some titillating hints of things in various transcripts and tape recordings that leave unanswered as many questions as they answer. We have the Captain Hazelwood saying, "We have a little problem here with the third mate." Nobody has explained what that problem, for example, was.
Who's expected to testify in Anchorage?
There are 27 witnesses who have been subpoenaed so far, according to the NTSB spokesperson. We expect that those will include most of the tanker crew, a number of Coast Guard officers perhaps, very likely some of the Alyeska pipeline terminal operators. The precise list is not yet available.
But apparently not Joseph Hazelwood. Why not?
My understanding is that he has refused to talk to the NTSB from the very beginning and may be exercising some legal rights not to testify here because he is already under indictment in Alaska and so I suppose is able to avoid testifying on the grounds that he might incriminate himself in that criminal inquiry.
The NTSB hearings will deal with the operation of the tanker and the performance of its crew, and it's not the responsibility of the NTSB to assess the environmental damage that resulted from the accident. But I imagine those environmental issues continue to capture the attention of Alaskans. Can you bring us up to date on the status of the cleanup?
In fact, they do, Bob, and it will be frustrating, I think, for people to see a big official inquiry going ahead on the accident itself while knowing that the issue of cleanup is very much still in front of us. Exxon has come up with a new version of its cleanup plan released last week. There are probably three main points of contention at this point. The state of Alaska, for example, has objected strenuously to the plan, saying, among other things, it does not have any provision for cleaning beaches outside the Prince William Sound area. That oil has escaped now, a lot of it into the Gulf of Alaska and washed ashore as far as several hundred miles away in the Katmai National Monument. In addition, Exxon's latest version of the plan recommends that some of the beaches not be cleaned by Exxon, but left to Mother Nature, by and large, to clean up. They say that in some areas, some kinds of oiling, that will work better. And just last week, there was another surprise when the Exxon folks said that they want to bring in heavy equipment, bulldozers and backhoe tractors on some of these beaches to use them to try and scrape away the oiled rock. That's bound to be controversial as well.
Do we have a better idea now of the long-term effects of this spill?
We don't have a much better idea. What we have is more information, but unfortunately, a lot of it is contradictory. What it really proves is that during the 12 or 13 years that people were shipping oil through this sound, a lot of baseline questions were left unanswered. It might have seemed that somebody would have been testing some of these things, finding out, for example, what is the best way to take North Slope crude off of cold rocks and cold water. Apparently, those are questions that are only just beginning to be answered.
How is the accident affecting the way Alaskans perceive the oil industry?
I think that perhaps that will be one of the largest consequences of this bill, Bob. The Alaska legislature passed a whole series of very stringent tanker safety legislation and in addition repealed a tax break which had been granted to the oil companies that will cost them something between $150 million and $200 million a year. There was no direct link between the spill and the tax bill, but there was every kind of link between the oil company's credibility and their loss on that tax bill.
People having second thoughts about the trade-off between jobs and the potential environmental damage?
Alaskans, I think, believe that they could have their cake and eat it too. They have learned very sadly now that that's not the case.
Howard, thank you very much. Howard Weaver, managing editor of the Anchorage Daily News, speaking with us from the studios of the Alaska Public Radio Network. This is Morning Edition. I'm Bob Edwards. In Anchorage, Alaska, the National Transportation Safety Board has opened 5 days of hearings to determine why the supertanker Exxon Valdez ran aground on March 24th, spilling 11 million gallons of crude oil into Prince William Sound. Yesterday, the board heard testimony on what happened on the bridge of the tanker the night it plowed into Bligh Reef. Bruce Melzer of member station KSKA reports.
The NTSB has been trying to piece together the story of the Exxon Valdez without testimony from the man who was supposed to be commanding the vessel. Captain Joseph Hazelwood has been charged with operating his tanker under the influence of alcohol and two other misdemeanor charges in Alaska. Hazelwood declined to testify, but his crew told the safety board yesterday the trouble on the Exxon Valdez started when it sailed out of established tanker lanes. Third mate Greg Cousins testified a swath of icebergs from a nearby glacier appeared on his radar screen. The ice, he said, choked off the shipping lanes and forced him to shoot for a narrow strip of open water 0.9 mile wide next to the islands and reefs.
I commented to the captain that it looked like we'll be outside all the lanes, and he said yes, so we had to do.
Third mate Greg Cousins testified the captain put him in control of the ship, gave him instructions, and went below. Cousins says he took the ship off autopilot and then started turning when he saw the beacon at Busby Light, just as the captain told him to do. He turned the rudder 10 degrees right and got no response. Cousins says he then turned 20 degrees right and still nothing. Then he ordered a hard right.
Upon ordering the hard right rudder and taking several seconds at the radar, I called the captain. And I said to him at that time, I think we're in serious trouble. And even during that conversation, at the end of that conversation, is when I felt the initial shock to the vessel.
Third mate Greg Cousins told what happened, but the why is still unclear. Investigators have not been able to find out from the crew why the captain left the bridge right before the critical maneuver, what he was doing down below, and why he allowed Greg Cousins to control the ship, even though the third mate wasn't certified to navigate Prince William Sound. Time and time again, representatives from the state, Coast Guard, and Safety Board questioned Cousins' experience and his actions right before the tanker slammed into Bligh Reef. NTSB investigator William Woody asked the pilot who brought the Exxon Valdez out of the port, William Murphy, if the tanker could have avoided a wreck had the captain's orders been followed.
What I'm trying to determine is, within the maneuvering characteristics that you're familiar with on the vessel, would it be difficult to extricate from that situation?
In my opinion, no.
Pilot William Murphy also testified the captain didn't stay on the bridge during the transit of the dangerous Valdez Narrows, an unusual decision for the ship's master. It was Murphy who testified he smelled alcohol on Captain Hazelwood's breath, although he said it did not appear to affect the captain's performance. Third mate Greg Cousins and other crew members who came in contact with Captain Hazelwood that night said they didn't smell alcohol. Blood tests after the accident revealed Hazelwood had been drinking. Scores of questions remain. Over the next few days, the National Transportation Safety Board will be trying to sort them out. The final report could take up to a year to complete. For National Public Radio, I'm Bruce Melzer in Anchorage, Alaska.
A stress factor is being added to the already strenuous working conditions for crews cleaning up the Alaska oil spill. Bears. All along the Alaska coast, grizzlies and black bears are coming out of hibernation and heading for the beach. The bears expect to satisfy their appetites, but they're finding men in yellow rubber suits. To keep these meetings from becoming confrontational, the Alaska Department of Fish and Game has dispatched wildlife biologist Larry Vandale, who joins us from Valdez. To set the scene for us, how many bears are we talking about?
The cleanup takes place over a broad area, starting essentially from where the Exxon Valdez hit the rocks all the way out to almost the Aleutian chain right now. So we're dealing with several different habitats and several different densities of bears. Here close to Valdez, Cordova, and in Prince William Sound, most of the bears are black bears, the smaller variety of the types that we're dealing with. We don't know exactly how many there are. We assume that there's approximately one per square mile in some of these areas. When you get out to the areas west of here, such as Kodiak Island and the Alaska Peninsula, you get into the home of the larger cousin, which is the Alaska brown bear, a type of grizzly bear. In those areas, you have the highest grizzly bear populations in the world. Again, one grizzly bear per square mile, approximately, in some of the areas.
Now, what about the cleanup crews? Have they found any bears so far?
Oh, yeah. There have been bear-human encounters of various kinds with cleanup crews. And something you should realize is most cleanup crew operations aren't like you see on TV. They have some where they have 40 and 60 people on the beaches with hoses and so forth, but you also have the other extreme where you have crews of two people walking the beaches looking for dead birds. If you have the big crews, you're not going to have bear problems, more than likely, unless there's garbage laying around or some reason for the bears to come in. However, if you have crews of a couple people that are just kind of walking along a beach, that's when you may have a bear encounter.
I trust there hasn't been anything awful yet.
No, neither from the bear's standpoint nor the people's standpoint.
Good. Are the workers prepared to deal with these visitors?
Exxon is hiring people to be what they call bear guards. And they stand out with the larger crews. They're planning to arm them with firearms. And their main job is to watch out for bears along the perimeter. If they see bears, they're instructed to gather the folks up and vacate the beach if they can. If the bear is menacing and it appears that it's going to hurt someone, they're qualified to kill the bear.
Isn't that the crucial question? How do you know if the bear is menacing?
Well, it's actually possible to tell if a bear is menacing, and that's the reason Fish and Game has gotten deeply involved in our bear safety training. Bears are a little more predictable than people give them credit for. They usually go through a series of postures, and you can read their behavior, read their, what we like to call their bear talk or bear language, to see what they're up to. It's real similar to if you're walking down the street and you see a big dog. Not every big dog is going to chase you, but you can kind of tell if that dog's threatening to you or if he's just barking at you to bark at you or whatever. Same is true with bears. You can kind of read what they're telling you.
All right, a bear is coming at me and will not stop. I should take that to be menacing.
It depends on the situation. Most bear charges are what are called bluff charges. Very rarely in the bear world does a bear either touch another bear or touch a human. It seems that they've evolved over the years to go through these postures before they actually get into physical contact. You know, when you're dealing with a critter that's as big as a bear, and some of these brown bears, they can be up to 1,500 pounds for a large male. There's no selective advantage for those bears to fight each other all the time. They'd end up injured quite often. So like people, or like dogs, they've developed a series of what we call postures. They warn you. They try to tell you, I'm tougher than you are, therefore you should go away, or I'll hurt you. If you read what they're saying properly and you respond properly, it's unlikely that you'll get mauled.
Body language.
Body language. Good word.
Thank you very much. Larry Van Dale is a wildlife biologist with the state of Alaska. He spoke with us from Valdez.
This is the second day of hearings on the Alaska oil spill before the National Transportation Safety Board in Anchorage, Alaska. Although the captain of the Exxon Valdez has declined to testify, the other ship's officers are talking, providing firsthand accounts of the grounding of the tanker. Bruce Melzer of member station KSKA in Anchorage is anchoring the broadcast of those hearings, and he joins us now. Bruce, I gather that what happened today is we got the first strong sense of what it was like to be on that tanker when it ran aground.
That's right, Linda. On the stand today was James Kunkel, who was the chief mate of the Exxon Valdez, the most senior officer next to the captain. And he was actually asleep at the time that the accident took place. He was down in his stateroom and said that he was awakened by the jolt. He heard a scraping of metal snapping, and he, for the first time, was one of the ones who actually talked on an emotional level and gave us a little picture of what it was like, and here's what he had to say about it.
I don't mind telling you that at that moment I knew that my world would never be the same again. I feared for my life at the time. I wondered if I'd see my wife again, and I had no idea of how bad this was, but it was the worst thing I'd ever been involved in.
He had gone up to the bridge to assess the situation. He had talked with the third mate, Greg Cousins, who was at the helm at the time that the Exxon Valdez went to ground. Cousins, by the way, was not actually certified to be at the helm of a ship in Prince William Sound. He had gone up to Cousins. Cousins says, we're hard aground, the captain knows. At that point, the captain was not on the bridge. Later on, he reported to the captain, Kunkel reported to the captain, and wanted to know how they should deal with the crew.
I told the master of the situation and asked him if we should ring the general alarm. He told me, no, Jim, the most important thing to do is to stay calm and let's get a good assessment before we fly off the handle.
Now, at that point, did they understand that not only had they run aground, but that oil was pouring out of the ship?
By the time he asked for a general alarm, yes, they did understand that. Kunkel went down into the room where they control the load, where they look at the gauges for the oil, and he started doing structural assessment to find out where the oil was, to find out what was leaking.
And to my horror, the tanks had lost quite a bit of cargo, with average to about a 10-foot loss of cargo in the tanks.
Cargo, I gather, if you're on a tanker, is oil.
Cargo is oil pouring out into Prince William Sound, and in a matter of an hour or less, they had lost 10 feet of cargo. 10 feet of oil had dropped in the level of their tanks. He said he knew that it was absolutely terrible. And interestingly enough, the other crew members we heard from yesterday didn't really have a sense of that. They did not have a sense of how bad things were. Kunkel was well aware of the situation, and obviously the captain, Joseph Hazelwood, was. At one point, Hazelwood said to him, well, this is one way to end a career.
We heard in testimony yesterday from the third mate, the, in effect, unlicensed driver of this tanker, that the captain had set a course for the reef and then put the ship on automatic pilot and gone downstairs.
Whether or not the ship was on autopilot when it shouldn't have been is still very, very much up in the air. And in fact, we're getting some contradictions in the testimony. And really, a lot of it boils down to Captain Hazelwood. Why did he do what he did? And where was he? Why wasn't he around when critical decisions had to be made? And at this point, he is the shadowy figure who is not going to be testifying here.
Bruce Melzer of member station KSKA in Alaska.
In Anchorage today, the National Transportation Safety Board will conduct a third day of hearings on the March 24th Exxon oil spill in Alaska's Prince William Sound. Last night, the NTSB released evidence confirming that the captain of the tanker, Exxon Valdez, had a history of alcoholism. An Exxon disability report filed in 1985 shows Captain Joseph Hazelwood had been hospitalized for excessive drinking that was affecting his job performance. The possible role that alcohol played in the Valdez accident was prominent in yesterday's testimony. Robert Hawk of Alaska Public Radio reports.
Two people involved in the early stages of the Exxon Valdez oil spill testified Wednesday. One of them was Lieutenant Commander Thomas Falkenstein. He was among the first Coast Guard officials to arrive at the scene of the disaster. In what's getting to be a familiar line of questioning here, investigators asked Falkenstein to describe the captain's condition.
Did you detect any odor of alcohol from the master at that time?
In the initial meeting, yes.
Would you characterize it as strong or obvious?
Obvious.
Okay. About how far from the master could you detect the odor of what was apparently alcohol?
About 2.5 feet.
The Coast Guard officer went on to testify that he couldn't tell if Captain Hazelwood was impaired by drinking. But Falkenstein says he called his commander and suggested that a state trooper be sent to the vessel with enough field sobriety tests for the captain and the rest of the crew. Those crew members who have already testified all say they had no indication Captain Hazelwood had been drinking. But 11 hours after the wreck, the captain's blood alcohol level was 0.06, well above the limit for operating commercial vessels. Dr. Mike Peet, a toxicologist brought in to testify, estimated that the captain's blood alcohol could have been 0.22 at the time of the wreck. Peet was asked if such a reading would affect the captain's seamanship.
Yes, his judgment functions and other functions associated with mental acuity and vision would be impaired.
Documents prepared by the National Transportation Safety Board and introduced as evidence alleged that the captain was seen drinking while on shore in Valdez shortly before the tanker left port. The captain and his attorney have declined to appear at these hearings, but are scheduled for a court date next month. The other star witness on Wednesday was James Kunkel, the first mate of the tanker. He says he was trying to get some sleep after a long shift when he was awakened by a shudder that ran through the ship, followed by a clanging metallic sound. Kunkel says he jumped out of bed, grabbing his cold water survival suit, and made his way down to the cargo hold.
And to my horror, the tanks had lost quite a bit of cargo.
Kunkel testified that within the first 15 to 30 minutes after the tanker hit the reef, an estimated 115,000 barrels of North Slope crude poured out of the tanker. According to Exxon, the total amount spilled was 260,000 barrels, about 11 million gallons. Kunkel says when he watched the cargo gauges showing oil leaking out and water coming in, he didn't think he'd make it through the night.
I don't mind telling you that at that moment I knew that my world would never be the same again. I feared for my life at the time. I wondered if I'd see my wife again. And I had no idea of how bad this was, but it was the worst thing I'd ever been involved in.
The first mate says when he got back to the bridge, the damage to the tanker was becoming more evident as petroleum vapors filled the air. He says at that time, the captain and other senior officers had a nervous conversation.
The master mentioned that, this is one way to end a career. It was quite obvious that this was going to be a major, major problem.
During the next 2 days, investigators plan to work their way up the chain of command. Still to testify are more Coast Guard officials, the captain who took over the grounded tanker, state environmental officers, and executives with Exxon Oil Company. As these hearings continue, the focus will shift to the initial response to the March 24th accident. For National Public Radio, I'm Robert Hawk in Anchorage.
The National Transportation Safety Board hearings on the Valdez oil spill continued in Anchorage, Alaska. Today, the ship's chief engineer testified he went drinking with his captain shortly before the tanker left port. The leaders of the Exxon Corporation faced their own examination on the East Coast today. The Exxon Corporation held its annual shareholders meeting in Parsippany, New Jersey. Today's meeting was marked by some fierce attacks on the company's management from both stockholders and environmental demonstrators protesting the oil spill in Prince William Sound. NPR's Mike Schuster has a report.
Exxon's chairman Lawrence Rawl began the annual meeting by telling the some 2,000 shareholders present that Exxon had spent more than $115 million so far to clean Prince William Sound, and that the plan to complete the cleanup by mid-September was on schedule. Then Rawl showed a short film produced for the company that was meant to demonstrate what a good job Exxon is doing.
Shock and disbelief have given way to increasing confidence that a methodical and persistent cleanup operation will succeed, sooner, not later. Almost 2 months have passed since the accidental spill by the Exxon Valdez. To date, about three-quarters of the oil has evaporated, dispersed, or been cleaned up. In all of Prince William Sound, less than 10% of the 4,000-mile coastline was affected.
But activists were not the least persuaded. Environmentalist Ed Rothschild was one of the first to challenge Chairman Rawl.
The shareholders and the board need to have a new set of people. We have that in our government. When people make mistakes, they're thrown out of office. And I think a new set of people to deal with these circumstances, to set the company on a new course, would be the right thing to do. And the question is, will you resign? And if not, why not?
The answer is no, I won't.
Rawl did say that Exxon's board of directors would study whether responsibility for the spill rested with anyone in the company other than those on the Exxon Valdez. But Dorothy Edinburgh pressed the point that the company's senior management should not come out of this unscathed.
I want to know if management intends not to take their bonus this year, not to take stock option, and to demonstrate in some way that you've got some bloody responsibility.
Jay Hare, president of the National Wildlife Federation, called on the company to place $1 billion in a trust fund for the cleanup. And he implored the directors of Exxon, including Chairman Lawrence Rawl, to go to Alaska to see the effects of the spill.
Go to the native villages and see the anger and see the hurt and see the apprehension of those people whose lives may have been changed for all of time. Put yourself in their place. If tomorrow morning you were to wake up and your very livelihood had been threatened in a way that may never be as it was. Also, I would encourage you to walk the beaches, to smell the oil, to see the dead and dying animals. Let me assure you that Exxon has created in this nation our worst environmental disaster ever.
Mr. Hare is a nice guy. He's good looking and he's very, very smooth talking. However, he has a great facility for overstatement. Well, we're not forgetting about the people. We're not forgetting about the animals. We're not forgetting about the shareholders. And we're damn sure going to stay there and we're going to clean that thing up.
The discussion of the oil spill continued off and on for several hours, with environmentalists and Exxon management each getting frustrated with the other, neither side conceding any ground. This is Brent Blackwelder of Friends of the Earth.
I have not heard the kind of decisive answers that I think should be forthcoming from the management, and I cannot report back unless some further action is taken.
How decisive can you get when you say we're going to clean it up, we're spending all of this money? What do you want me to say to you that would make you happy? To say I'm going to make it disappear out there? Because I can't, but we're going to get it all out of there, and we're going to get it out of there on that plan, and hopefully we can beat that plan. And I'll guarantee you I'm sincere in that. Because it's in your interest, the public's interest, and certainly in my interest, and this corporation's interest.
Oh, well, I woke up this morning with my mind, it was set on the cleanup.
Outside the Exxon meeting, several hundred demonstrators carried signs demanding, make Exxon pay. The speaker said he had his own proposal for Exxon management.
That the name of Exxon forever be changed to Toxon. And that Toxon immediately adopt as its creed that Toxon will not discriminate based upon any differences. Toxon will continue to pollute you and destroy you, whether you're in Alaska or whether you're in New Jersey or wherever you are throughout the world.
Last week, several pension fund managers persuaded the company to put an environmentalist on its board this year. But activist Barry Commoner said environmentalists needed to seize control of the company.
It's nonsense to put one environmentalist on there as a token. What we need to do is to take over Exxon.
Little was accomplished today at the Exxon meeting, but it must certainly be clear that many are watching Exxon's performance in its cleanup effort, with insiders and outsiders alike ready to challenge the company publicly if it does not get the job done. This is Mike Schuster reporting.